Hello, thank you for joining us today. My name's Laura Gordon. I'm a project finance lawyer at DLA Piper in the Energy and Infrastructure team. I'm joined today by my colleagues Dan D'Ambrosio and Stephen Gray.
Hi, Laura. Thanks. My name's Stephen Gray, also from DLA Piper. I'm international environmental lawyer specialising on climate change.
Hi, I'm Daniel D'Ambrosio. I'm a business and human rights lawyer at DLA Piper.
Today's webinar is going to be about the recent updates that have been made to the Equator Principles. We are going to be covering the detail of what those changes are and how they fit into the wider context of ESG and sustainability. We're going to be looking in particular about the new substantive requirements that have been introduced in relation to climate change, human rights, and Indigenous people. We're going to be thinking through some of the practical implications of those changes for sponsors and for lenders. And we'll try and offer some practical tips for how lenders and sponsors might meet the challenges of the new requirements. One thing I would say is we do welcome questions. We would love to engage with you and answer any questions you have on the material we're covering today. Please do see the box at the bottom of your screens and feel free to submit any questions that you'd like us to cover. So, this new version of the Equator Principles has come out a good 6 or 7 years after the last update, after version 3 was published in 2013. And it obviously raises the bar for the financial community in terms of the identification, assessment of environmental and social risks and how those are managed and mitigated. I think before we get into the detail of those requirements, it's really important, therefore, just to step back slightly and think about the context in which these changes are being made, because the world now is a very different place to 2013. The environmental and social governance space is very much exploding at the moment, and there's a lot of terminology that's being used, such as ESG, sustainability, responsible investment, and I think those terms aren't always clearly used, or the context in which they're used isn't always understood. Stephen, what do we mean when we talk about sustainability and ESG?
Yes, well, sustainability is not necessarily a new concept. It's been around for over 30 years. However, in the context of business and corporations, it relates to the ability to create and maintain long-term value. The factors such as environmental, social, and governance factors are the factors used to measure the sustainability of corporations in relation to the long term. It is a convoluted space in the sense that some of the more established standards have been founded around in 2010, 2011. So we've had a decade of these standards emerging and consolidating, but there is a number of them, and they have different definitions and they have different methodologies as to how they rate companies. So we are confronted with a complex picture, because it is sometimes difficult to compare companies in the same sector, given the use of different metrics. So we constantly hear the need for harmonization or alignment or standardization of these criteria. Now, it's also going to the broader context, it is quite time critical right now, the action and activities towards safeguarding and guaranteeing sustainability, given the impacts that we've already seen on the natural and social capital. We have pretty much the next decade, from 2020 to 2030, to peak emissions and start mitigation in greenhouse gas emissions dramatically in order to maintain temperature rise to a comfortable or a level that we can deal with in an orderly fashion. Likewise, the Sustainable Development Goals were set up in 2015. And the deadline to or for achieving those goals is 2030. So it is a decade of action. In the space of climate in particular, this is a very important year given the cycle of the Paris Agreement. The Paris Agreement was adopted in 2015. It sets a framework for national governments to determine their contribution to mitigation and adaptation of climate. And they are supposed to come to the table every 5 years to update those commitments and or, in this case, hopefully increase the ambition of those commitments. This year in 2020, the UK will host what is referred to as COP26. In November, where for 2 weeks over 190 governments will meet and hopefully come up with a race in ambition and a concrete action for implementation. So that's kind of the broader context of climate.
Thanks, Stephen. I noticed you used the phrase time critical there. Dan, why is this agenda now time critical?
Well, I think Stephen gave a really good explanation of why, in relation to climate change, we're at an urgent point where action needs to be taken. But the urgency doesn't just relate to the E in ESG, but the S and the G are also critical to be addressed at the moment. And that's partly because of the holistic nature in which these issues have to be dealt with by businesses and other stakeholders. So, for example, in relation to the S and the G, the Me Too movement has put workplace harassment and gender equality front and centre. Not a week or a month goes by without stories in the news about workers making parts to our smartphones, or sourcing cobalt for renewable batteries, or building stadiums for major global sporting events and their treatment and potential exploitation. And there's constant news and press, especially around election time, about the negative reputational impacts of corporate tax strategies, raising the issues of tax fairness. So all of these issues are coming together to paint a picture of an agenda, sustainability and ESG, that really does need to be addressed quite urgently. And so in response, we've seen a number of things happen, and policymakers are playing an active role, but also businesses and other stakeholders. So in terms of policymakers, we've seen a real increase in hard law regulation and a hardening of voluntary commitments. And I guess just before I move on, it's important to say, as Stephen said, these issues have been dealt with for many, many years. And the change now is that there's a real focus on dealing with them together holistically and through mandatory measures. So, Stephen, in relation to climate change, you know, you mentioned a few things, but the last few years, and certainly over the next few years, we will see a significant increase in regulation and mandatory requirements around climate risk. Do you want to just mention a little bit about some of those trends?
We'll go into more detail further on in terms of the disclosure frameworks, but I guess it's fair to say at this stage that a watershed moment in climate action was 2015, when the Financial Stability Board acknowledged that climate impacts were of material risk to financial stability. This declaration led to the establishment of an industry-led task force for climate-related financial disclosure, better known as TCFD, and that's an acronym that we'll be using throughout this presentation, because the new version of the Equator Principles makes reference to the TCFD. TCFD, after 2 years from 2015, came up with its recommendations in 2017. Since then, we've had 2-3 years of disclosures, mainly financial institutions, but other sectors also have been taking attention to this and following that framework. I won't say more now, because we'll go to it in more detail as it relates to the Equator Principles.
And similarly, with respect to another sort of area under the ESG banner, human rights, we've seen an increase in recent years of regulation requiring businesses to disclose their human rights policies, processes, performance, generally converging with certain international frameworks. The trend there with regulation is moving now to more mandatory reporting requirements with mandatory reporting criteria. And then a step beyond that will be, and we've seen this in some jurisdictions, hard compliance requirements for businesses to develop systems that deal with involvement in adverse human rights impacts. Separate to regulation, developments in practice have really pushed the urgency of this agenda. So we've seen businesses make commitments to net zero by 2050. We've seen businesses commit to science-based targets. So there's a real appetite to address this agenda. And I guess the only other point to emphasize about the urgency of this agenda is that the impact on businesses when things go wrong is quite significant. And so just to pull out two examples, we've seen a significant increase in climate change litigation against or involving businesses in recent years, originating in the US but now stemming to other jurisdictions, and similarly with litigation against businesses or involving businesses for involvement in adverse human rights impacts. There's been a significant uptick in large-scale disputes and crises involving these issues. So the urgency of the agenda really means that businesses need to take account, develop a consistent approach, and perhaps draw on tools and guidance available that are specific to different business activities and investments. And so that's probably a really good segue, Laura, to update on the changes to the Equator Principles.
Thank you very much. Thanks both for setting the context for some of these changes. So I think if we now move to what those changes are, I think they probably fit into two main categories. So the first category is changes in relation to the scope of application of the Equator Principles, and the second is the substantive requirements of the Equator Principles themselves. So to take the scope and application area first, until the new version of the Equator Principles, there were four main categories of financial products to which the Equator Principles applied. And those were obviously project finance, but also project finance advisory services, project-related corporate loans, and bridging finance. The new version expands those four categories by adding a new fifth category, which is project-related refinancing and acquisition financing. Now, that's subject to a couple of conditions, and I think it's really important to understand those conditions because they do limit that scope a little bit further back. So project-related refinancings and acquisitions are only within the scope of the Equator Principles version 4 if the Equator Principles previously applied to the project, but most importantly, only if the project has not yet reached completion. The other main changes to the scope are in relation to project-related corporate loans. So firstly, there has been a removal of the aggregate loan amount threshold, which was $100 million. So that removal means that the base commitment requirement for a lender to fall within the scope is $50 million US. There's also been a removal of the exemption that previously existed for project-related corporate loans to sovereign borrowers. So a loan to a regional government, national government, local government, or a development agency of a government would now be within scope, which makes sense in the same way that a loan to a government-owned entity was previously within scope. So it regularises the playing field for sovereign-related entities. There has also been an inclusion now of expansions and upgrades for all projects. So previously, expansions and upgrades were only within scope if they may have a particular impact for environmental and social risks. But now any expansion or upgrade would be within scope. I think that probably leads us to quite an interesting provision, which is there is now an express acknowledgement that the Equator Principles may also be voluntarily applied by financial institutions to other financial products. So there are obviously now over 100 financial institutions that have signed up to the Equator Principles, and their own circumstances and their appetite for responsible lending may vary. And I think this acknowledgement just makes it clear that the Equator Principles set the kind of the baseline for all of the lenders who have signed up to them, but it doesn't mean that individual financial institutions aren't encouraged to take that a step further if they are able to do so. The other changes that have been made are particularly in relation to designated countries. So the concept of a designated country is retained in version 4. And that is a high-income OECD country. But what has changed is previously there was a kind of a deemed compliance concept under which the regulatory framework in those countries was deemed to meet certain standards such that lenders didn't then need to do due diligence beyond what was already established in that host country. And what lenders now need to do is actually not only to ensure that their sponsor or borrower is complying with the applicable law requirements in the country in which the project is located, but also taking that one step further and analysing the specific risks of the project in question and whether actually, notwithstanding the host country's framework, there might be additional IFC principles that might be relevant and which they might want to consider asking their borrower or sponsor to comply with to ensure that the relevant risks are appropriately identified, assessed and managed. The final point I wanted to draw out here was really just a relatively minor drafting change, but it's worth remembering that the requirements that the lenders will then seek to impose on their borrowers by way of representations, undertakings and events of default in their facilities agreements should be done in a collaborative fashion, and that is expressly acknowledged in the Equator Principles. It isn't the case that a borrower who breaches these requirements should immediately find themselves in event of default territory with their loans being accelerated. What should be happening is that the relevant financial institutions should be working with the borrower or sponsor to actually identify that issue and remediate it. So there should be, and the Equator Principles now do acknowledge, that there is a mandated grace period to fix those sorts of issues. And that was previously a concept, and I think it very much reflects what is happening in practice anyway, but it's a useful reminder just as the drafting there has been slightly adjusted. So I think that probably takes us on to some of the substantive requirement changes. And the first one relates to climate change. Stephen, climate change is very much on everybody's lips at the moment. How do the Equator Principles seek to address the climate change area?
Thanks, Laura. Well, indeed, the climate is in some jurisdictions been declared as a climate emergency, so it is top of the agenda in many instances. But as it relates to the Equator Principles, we have that there's a new climate change risk assessment, and this is explicitly referred to and aligned with the TCFD that I've mentioned earlier. So category A and B of projects will have to have a relevant physical risk analysis. Also, projects with 100,000 tons of emissions per year will have to look into not only the physical risk, but also the transitional risks of climate. And I'll come back to these risks in a minute. And also these projects with 100,000 or more of emissions per year will have to do an alternatives analysis. I'll start with alternative analysis. What does this mean? This means that in the design, construction and operation of the project, sponsors will have to look at ways of how the project will reduce emissions or different options for it to reduce emissions by looking at different fuels or technologies that it can be applied. And they would have to make an analysis from a technical perspective, from a financial feasibility perspective, and a cost effectiveness of options. This will result then in a clear articulation and justification of why a specific option was deemed the most adequate for the project in question. So that's the assessment in terms of alternatives. If we look at then the physical risk and the transitional risk, which relates to this new requirement of climate change assessment, the reference is the TCFD, and the TCFD outlines what is understood by physical risk and transition risk. In terms of physical risk, these risks relate to acute or chronic. Acute are event-driven moments which relate to a specific cyclone or hurricane, typhoon. And the chronic refer to long-term changes in climate patterns. So sponsors will have to make an analysis in relation to how these risks and opportunities may impact a project. In relation to the physical risk, we have quite well-defined pathways of emissions by the relevant intergovernmental panel on climate change. And what is clear from those emissions pathways is that the impacts, the physical impacts of climate change, regardless of limiting emissions immediately, we have clarity on those impacts up to 2050, regardless, I repeat, of the emissions emitted now. That means that the impacts that we're seeing on our natural environment refer to emissions emitted in the past. So that, as scary as that may be, it does provide some kind of clarity as to assessing the impacts, the physical impacts that these may have on a particular project. The transition risks are slightly more nuanced with uncertainty, given that these refer to different scenarios where different assumptions as to the speed of action, the different policies, the different laws will come into play to help drive emissions down and create resilience in the economy. Physical risks, transition risks are broken down in the TCFD in five categories. These are policy risk, legal risk, reputational risk, technology risk, and market risk. So this implies a forward-looking assessment of what these implications may be in relation to a particular project. So as I mentioned, the climate change assessment anticipates these two aspects of risks. It also lays clear that plans and processes, policies, systems have to be in place in the context of the project to mitigate, transfer, accept, or control these risks. And the last point in relation to this, it's a very important one given the precedent that we have now in the UK from last week, is how this project will impact how compatible it is with the host country's climate commitments. As you may know, in the UK, there was a ruling last week that deemed that the new runway planned runway in Heathrow is not compatible with the UK's Paris Agreement. So this is also part of what is expressed in the new requirement of the Equator Principles, and one that cannot be underestimated. The last point, it relates to the quantification and reporting of emissions itself during the operation of the projects. And the Equator Principles are clear that if your project has more than 100,000 tons of CO2 equivalent emitted during a year, you are mandated to report in line with the greenhouse Gas Protocol, which is an established framework which identifies the method and metrics for measuring emissions. So if you are in that threshold, you are mandated to report publicly yearly. And if you fall below this threshold and above 25,000 tons per year, you're encouraged to make this reporting public. So that is what the new requirements point towards in relation to climate change.
Thanks very much, Stephen. Dan, how about some of the changes that have been made in relation to human rights?
Sure. So there have been a few changes made in relation to human rights, which may seem overwhelming at first, but actually will just require a bit of work up front to develop an appropriate approach. And then the idea is that this is just integrated into the way that these projects are developed. So the first, I guess, key change is a UNGP-aligned assessment of human rights impacts. So I guess before explaining that, maybe just a bit of background. The UNGP refers to the UN Guiding Principles on Business and Human Rights, and this is a key international soft law framework that was unanimously adopted by the UN Human Rights Council in 2011, and which has since that time informed the development of significant international and domestic policy initiatives. Significantly, it aligns with other key international standards like the OECD guidelines on multinational enterprises. But importantly, it has informed the development of domestic regulation across a number of jurisdictions. And some of those trends I was mentioning earlier, reporting obligations, moving towards compliance obligations, are modelled on the UNGP. So it's an important framework, and it's not without consequences. The important framing for the Equator Principles of a UNGP-aligned human rights impact assessment, or assessment of human rights impacts, means that there'll be a few tweaks that are required to the current sort of environmental and or social impact assessments that are undertaken. And so just to pull out a few of the key ones, the framing of the risk assessment needs to be risks to people and not just material risks to business. Now, the two are interrelated because having sort of salient risks to people that are not addressed or managed properly can lead to material risks to the business. And so in the project context, it might be that there's a cost associated with conflict with the community. There's a delay to project delivery time. There might be a cost incurred to repair or add further security to installations and project sites because local stakeholders weren't consulted or didn't give their consent, and so there's no social license to operate. So the framing of the risk assessment really does need to be on those risks to people, and importantly, as the UNGP outlines, the normative baseline should be internationally recognised human rights. So that should also help to bring some consistency to the assessment of social risks in project financing and development. And it's also important, I guess, to point out that social risks and human rights risks are not different. They are the same thing. The narrative traditionally has been environmental and social risks, but the direction of travel is such that social risks should be addressed with reference to the emerging business and human rights landscape. A couple of the other changes are process-based. So the diligence and the assessment processes that are undertaken should not be overly onerous. They should be specific to the context, the size of the business, the context of the operating context, and also the risk to stakeholders. So there is some ability based on the UN Guiding Principles for the process to be contextualised. It's not intended to be a pick-up-off-the-shelf assessment process. It really does need to be embedded into what businesses, sponsors, lenders are doing. And then a few procedural steps that sponsors and lenders will just need to think about and make sure that the assessments that are being undertaken include, and they are that adverse human rights impacts are identified and assessed, that the findings of these assessments are integrated into the project documents, into the processes, so that appropriate action can be taken, that steps that are taken to address these impacts are monitored and tracked, and so that there's a process of continuous improvement, and that there's communication of the steps that are being taken to address adverse impacts. Importantly, there's also an acknowledgement of the need to engage in remediation processes. So we'll come to that in a moment around grievance mechanisms, but that's quite an important point. not just in terms of addressing issues that come up when things go wrong, but also in the context of an ongoing due diligence process. Another change is the specific calling out of a potentially affected stakeholder group, and that is workers. So typically with large-scale infrastructure and other projects, the key stakeholders that have adverse human rights impacts are communities surrounding the project site, Indigenous communities in particular. But what the update to the Equator Principles does is it says that actually, let's not forget also about this other key stakeholder group, and they've included explicit reference to workers. So note a couple of things about this. It's not employees, it's workers, and workers is broadly defined to include direct and indirect workers. So this does include suppliers, temporary and full-time workers, but the key point is those that are engaged on the project site. So it doesn't extend to the whole supply chain, but it certainly does not just include workers or full-time employees of the project sponsor. I guess another key and important change with the new Equator Principles is that it applies a global standard for engagement with Indigenous peoples, and this is recognising a real challenge in some areas in relation to developing projects, and that is the process and the way by which sponsors and governments and others engage with Indigenous communities. So if the project has impacts on land or natural resources that are under traditional or customary use, or has impacts on or seeks to commercialise Indigenous cultural heritage, the requirement will be that engagement or compliance with the IFC performance standards is assessed in addition to host country laws, and this is for all projects. So here the distinction between designated and non-designated countries is irrelevant, because if Indigenous peoples are engaged, there will be a need to assess compliance with the IFC performance standards and the concept of free, prior and informed consent in addition to host country laws. And that's slightly challenging at the start for some sponsors and lenders because the concept of free, prior and informed consent is a concept which stems from international human rights law and jurisprudence, and at that level it's not yet settled. So there'll need to be a bit of an assessment, a bit of a gap analysis between how and whether host country laws actually incorporate that concept, if at all. And so sponsors and lenders will be well advised to take some legal advice on this gap and whether there is a gap and how compliance with IFC Performance Standard 7 can be met. Importantly, and acknowledging the practical reality of engagement with Indigenous communities, there is some flexibility for lenders to state that there might be a justified deviation from the IFC performance standards in relation to engagement with Indigenous communities, but this needs to be reasoned and done on the basis of advice that's taken, and they will also need to outline how additional corrective actions might be used to plug the gaps. And then finally, again, acknowledging the practical reality of engagement with Indigenous communities, which is often the responsibility of government, there's a requirement now that lenders ensure that project sponsors collaborate with or have some involvement, oversight or involvement in the process. And I guess this is to remedy a situation where previously, if consultation, engagement and compensation to Indigenous communities was the sole responsibility of the government, the affected businesses are actually the businesses on the site and the lenders. They're the ones that receive the advocacy, they're the ones that take the complaints, they're the ones that are targeted. And so actually this is a more of a practical step to push sponsors and lenders to consider issues which might actually end up impacting them. And I guess the final point to emphasise on the changes in relation to human rights is in relation to grievance mechanisms. So a very small tweak to the wording in the section on grievance mechanisms that they need to be effective, but when read with the preamble, this refers to grievance mechanisms that are developed with regard to the effectiveness criteria in the UN Guiding Principles. So this really relates to how the mechanism is developed, its legitimacy with a community, whether or not it's a credible process, and importantly, the accessibility of potentially affected stakeholders to use the mechanism. So there will need to be some regard had to the UNGP effectiveness criteria. And importantly, the grievance mechanisms will now need to also have regard to workers. And there's plenty of useful guidance being developed by the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in their accountability and remedy number three project, which is all about private grievance mechanisms, and there's a consultation underway at the moment, which anyone can get involved in, but the idea is that towards the end of the year, a report will go to the General Assembly on what an effective grievance mechanism looks like. So sponsors and lenders will have plenty of useful guidance available to them in that regard.
Thank you. So let's think now about what some of these changes mean for project sponsors who are involved in developing projects at the moment. I think the main thing is really that sponsors need to be, if they haven't been already, familiarising themselves with the new requirements of version 4 of the Equator Principles. They need to be considering the impact of those changes, and I think the impact will obviously be substantial potentially in those countries where at the moment the host country requirements for assessments of climate change, human rights and indigenous people doesn't at the moment comply with the new standards that are being brought in, and there may well therefore be material divergence. One of the tools that sponsors can undertake in that area is to have a legal gap analysis conducted to try and identify those divergences and think ahead to how they're going to manage to get their project financed and comply with the requirements that they will have to do at that point. I think impact assessments will need to evolve, and the mitigation measures which go alongside them as part of the action plans, I think they will need to evolve in the ways that have been outlined by Dan and by Stephen, in particular in relation to Indigenous people. Sponsors will need to make sure that the engagement is framed by reference to IFC Performance Standard 7 and free and prior informed consent. And in order to make their project bankable, sponsors will need to remember that it isn't sufficient just to comply with host country laws. That isn't going to be enough going forwards. I think it would be useful here maybe just to draw out an example from in practice, because this is something that is already starting to have an impact for sponsors and lenders. So one of the areas that I work in particular is renewable energy finance, and we've been doing a number of wind farm transactions in the Nordics. And if you start to look at projects further north within Norway or Sweden, you start to come up in your due diligence against issues potentially in relation to the Sami people, who are an indigenous semi-nomadic population in northern Sweden, Finland and Norway, who particularly, amongst other things, herd reindeer. So they're not always to be found in the same place. So obviously having the engagement and the consultations is quite a difficult task at times for sponsors anyway, in terms of finding the right people and making sure they're doing what they need to be doing. So we had a project which came up for closing towards the end of last year, and it was actually at that stage about the time when the new version of the Equator Principles was being published, but obviously there'd been a bit of a lead-in with the consultation process, so the lender knew really what was coming into force. So we had a sponsor who had done what they needed to do under the host country laws. They had complied with their permits, they'd engaged in the way that they were supposed to be engaging. But we had a lender who was looking at that situation and saying, okay, well, you've done what you need to do, but thinking ahead and taking a step back, actually, has what you've done constituted what we think is free prior informed consent? And the answer to that isn't necessarily the same as what's required under host country law. And that lender, knowing what was coming with the Equator Principles and being as forward thinking as they wanted to be, was then not necessarily comfortable with the position. So we had to work very carefully with the lender and the sponsor, together with Dan and his team in the firm who specialise in this area, to make sure that we were coming up with ways to move that issue forward so that the project could financially close and proceed in a way that enabled the lender to get comfortable, but the sponsors to still deliver their project and not suffer any delays. So just important to think about the fact that this is already playing out, despite the fact that the principles, the new version, won't actually come into force until July next year. thinking also from a lender perspective about what the changes mean. I think, again, the key message is familiarisation. Lenders will need to update their internal procedures, policies and documentation, their checklists, whatever it is they need to do to reflect the base requirements of which projects are now going to be within scope and what the substantive changes are. And they will also, in particular, need to consider what approach they're going to take to those elements where they are given some element of discretion under the Equator Principles. So, for example, are they going to apply the Equator Principles requirements to products which are not technically within the scope of the Equator Principles? Are they going to go with the baseline, or are they going to take that a little bit further? They will also need to consider, in particular, their approach to assessment for projects, particularly in Category B, which can fall within quite a wide scale of what the environmental and social risks are. And so what's appropriate for a Category B project at one end of the scale might be very different from the requirements for another Category B project. They will also need to think through quite carefully in advance what approach they might take and what might be their comfortable position where you have a sponsor who is unable to demonstrate FPIC. I think, again, key with this is going to be communication. So if lenders have reached decisions internally and formed positions on where they're going to go with these discretionary elements, it's going to be important for them to make sure they're communicating that up front to the sponsors and borrowers who they are currently working with and who they will be anticipating working with over the coming months and years, and making sure that there's a clarity of expectation there so that, again, those sponsors can proceed on an informed basis and make sure they're not having their projects delayed or impeded by the new requirements. I think, again, a gap analysis in the same way as for sponsors is something that many lenders may find useful in this area. Okay, so moving on then in terms of management of the risks that we've identified so far. Stephen, do you have any practical tips for what lenders and sponsors can do to address these?
Sure, thanks, Laura. Well, I guess back to the CFD, one of its successes so far is that it provides a structure which is relevant and relates to how business operates. And it also tries to put climate-related disclosure in the context of financial implications. Those two elements make it the reference point for now in relation to climate-related disclosures. And the structure that it provides is around four areas, and these refer to the governance, the strategy, the risk management, and metrics and targets. Now, I won't go into too much detail around those, but this structure provides the basis for how you would engage and address going through the assessment or climate change assessment of the various impacts. In terms of the governance, it's important to hear, describe and make distinct the role between oversight of the board and the role of management in assessing and managing the risks and opportunities. The strategy, this is where we are looking at a bit more innovation, or the need for a bit more innovation, because it relates to how are the climate-related impacts going to impact on your strategy and your financial planning going forward. So it's all about stress testing your strategy in order for it to be resilient against the different climate impacts. The TCFD suggests that you should be stress testing your strategy against different scenarios, and this would include a 2-degree scenario or below. So we've seen only just the emergence of some tools that help you do these, but this is the area where entities so far have been struggling the most. The other is risk management, but this relates to the process for identifying, assessing, managing the risks and how they get integrated into the overall risk management. And then obviously the metrics and targets, but these are, as mentioned before, kind of in line with the standards that are out there and how you report on greenhouse gas emissions. So here the objective is to disclose the metrics that you are using to assess your risks and opportunities, and to disclose scope 1 and 2 of greenhouse gas emissions, and if applicable, scope 3. Now, I cannot overemphasize how climate risk or climate-related impacts will have a material impact on your financial position. And in that regard, you want to be able to identify how these impacts will be impacting on your expenditure plans, on the cost of or increased cost of operations, and how you might need or you might foresee the need for additional debt or equity into a particular project over its cycle. Investors, when looking at this type of related risks, are looking at how the capital expenditure and operational expenditure will be in relation to climate risks. And so it's very important that you have a thorough approach to make sure that your plans are in one way or another future-proof and are taking into consideration these risks that we know, as I mentioned before, will be happening in terms of the physical, and then the response to transitioning to a net zero economy.
Thanks, Stephen. Any tips on the human rights side, Dan?
Yes, thanks, Laura. So many tips, but maybe we'll just focus on a few important things. I guess the first point and the most important thing is that there is no one-size-fits-all, and the management of involvement in adverse human rights impacts in any business situation, whether it's activities, supply chain, business relationships, needs to be contextualized. There is some support here in the Equator Principles in that there's a consistency of approach supported or encouraged by alignment with the UN Guiding Principles. So sponsors, lenders, those involved in project financing and development need to consider their impact assessments and just ensure that they are identifying the right risks, using the correct baseline, but then very importantly contextualizing that by stakeholder engagement. I think once the risk assessment is done and once risks have been properly identified, there can be more effective implementation throughout the project documents and processes. So, for example, pre-qualification criteria for suppliers to make sure that you are not using anyone with a particularly bad record on some of the issues that might arise. Supply chain controls to ensure that the manner of procurement is done in a certain way. For example, if you need to or should be engaging a local workforce. Specifications for contractors and employers, the use of KPIs, for example, to drive positive outcomes and incentives if certain environmental and social impacts or metrics are met. So there is quite an important role here for lawyers in developing the documents, the financing, the project, because of the oversight, because of their understanding of the way these things interact. So it's quite important that lawyers and advisors involved in this space draw in the relevant substantive expertise, and whether that's internally or externally, there really does or there really is an opportunity for innovation here. I guess the other tip would be in relation to engagement with Indigenous people. So not a huge change for non-designated countries, but for designated countries, as Laura said,
the approach of relying on host country laws is no longer adequate. And there have been countless examples. Laura gave one where projects in designated countries, compliance with local laws wasn't enough. There were still problems. So a structured approach to stakeholder engagement is really what's required, and there needs to be an acknowledgement that different stakeholders have different needs. And as I said, a one-size-fits-all approach won't work. There's guidance out there. The International Association for Public Participation has useful guidance on stakeholder engagement. The important things are identifying the right stakeholders, identifying them early enough, and importantly, especially in relation to Indigenous peoples, documenting the processes by which you're obtaining free, prior and informed consent. An interesting sort of concept which hasn't really been grappled with in practice very well to date is the requirement that FPIC is ongoing. So the requirement that there is an ongoing buy-in by Indigenous communities into the project, and that's challenging. And so perhaps here there's a role for more effective grievance mechanisms and more effective engagement in early remediation of issues, perhaps by bringing the parties together, perhaps by facilitated dialogue between the parties, perhaps by listening to their needs as individuals rather than waiting for it to become a group issue. And Laura mentioned earlier that there's a nod to this in the Equator Principles, which is sort of encouraging a collaborative approach, which from a human rights perspective is the most important thing, which is in continuous improvement. It's not helpful to focus on sanction, violation. In any case, private law remedies, contractual remedies don't necessarily give people what they've lost if they've had impacts on their human rights. So there needs to be a more innovative and thoughtful process around collaboration, especially around remedial actions, corrective actions, and specific actions to address issues that arise along the way. And I guess that's a useful leading to the final point around thinking about remedy in a more innovative and collaborative way, and rather than thinking about remediation as a ward once something has gone wrong, rather thinking about it as an ongoing conversation and just ensuring that people are brought along the journey.
Thank you. So as we approach the end of this webinar, I think we each wanted to just draw out a couple of final thoughts or key messages that are our kind of fundamental thinking in this area. So I think for me, the first one is probably the relationship between the Equator Principles and other green or sustainability finance initiatives in this space at the moment. And I think that interplay is going to be particularly interesting in the coming months and years. So there's obviously the Equator Principles very squarely aimed at project finance. But then if you move more into corporate lending, you have the LMA papers on green finance and more commonly implemented sustainability finance. And I think it will be interesting to see to what extent some of the kind of the high level principles in those papers, which are obviously very different from the detailed prescriptive provisions of the Equator Principles, might become prevalent in the project finance market. So the one that particularly jumps to mind is obviously the potential for margin ratchets, which apply to sustainability loans, where the margin will change depending on a borrower's performance in relation to certain identified environmental and social factors, might become relevant. The other one that I think is really interesting is the potential overlap between the project bond area. So you have the Green Bond Initiative from the International Capital Markets Association, and the relationship between that and what we've been talking about today may well become of interest in the coming months. My second key message is just to reiterate what we've all said a couple of times today, which is that timing is key. These changes come into force in July 2020, but they are being implemented and considered now, and lenders and sponsors need to be very much aware of that.
From my perspective, in relation to climate impacts, just very quickly, two key messages. One is that climate impacts will also have a direct impact on the S, on the social aspect. So very important to remember that. Most environmental impacts have a direct impact on society. So that's one of them. And the other, in terms of how it relates, or put it this way, the largely the financial impact on a project in relation to climate-related issues will be determined by three main elements. One is your exposure to climate risks and opportunities. The second, how you plan to respond and manage these risks and opportunities. And thirdly, the implications of such plans response in terms of your income, cash flow, and balance sheet.
I guess from my perspective, two sort of key takeaways or key messages. And the first is really for advisors, lawyers involved in the project financing or project development, and that is around the soft standards. You know, there's a perception, I guess, that soft standards, soft laws, soft frameworks don't have hard consequences, and that's fundamentally, increasingly incorrect. You might have a reputation risk clause in your loan agreements that could be engaged because of disputes with the local community. You might have, and these are real examples that we've had experience on, public advocacy campaigns that reach international human rights complaints bodies in relation to big projects, which then force significant reputational consequences and impacts on investor relations, or complaints to non-judicial complaints mechanisms in different jurisdictions, which then force a rethink of policies and procedures, or full-blown disputes and litigation in this space. And as I mentioned earlier, there's an increasing legal risk landscape related to commitments to international soft law standards and soft frameworks where they're not implemented properly. And I guess the only final thing that I would say is that the yardstick is very clearly not what the regulator says in this space, it's what the community says. So I think the Equator Principles, if there's one thing to sum up my observation of the new Equator Principles, is it's moved the yardstick to community expectations. And this is a really interesting trend we're seeing across different areas of law, policy, and across different jurisdictions. And I guess just to end with one anecdote, there was a Royal Commission in Australia into the banking sector over the last few years, and one of the really interesting interactions between the banking executives and the commission, which was led by a former High Court judge, and the questions to the banking executives were, but did you meet community expectations? And the response was, we took legal advice and we did what was legal. And there was a very clear acknowledgement that that just wasn't enough. And I think the same is applied here and across a number of other areas in relation to sustainability and ESG, and that is the social license and community expectations are now fundamentally front and centre.
Thanks, Dan. I think that's a really good key message to end on today. So just on the housekeeping front, for anybody who's now filling in their continuing competencies forms, this webinar is designed to help solicitors meet requirements A2, maintain competence and legal knowledge, and A4, draw on detailed knowledge, understanding of the SRA statement of solicitor competence. Please submit any feedback via the survey screen. This webinar will be archived immediately, but will remain available for viewing for the next 24 months. A transcript of the webinar can be made available on request. And thank you again from the DLA Piper team for joining us today. Have a good day.